The general topic for this week is physiological aspects of human sexuality. The third all-university lecture on this topic will be tomorrow, January 8th, at 4 o'clock in the auditorium. John Gagnon will be speaking on Sex, a Cultural Artifact. The topic next week will be cultural perspectives. The three lecturers will be Dr. Tom F. Driver, Dr. Weston Labar, and Dr. Gerard Newbeck. Everyone is encouraged to attend. It will be beneficial to hear each week's lectures because they are set up in such a way as to present a diversified outlook on all aspects of sexuality. I would now like to present to you Mr. Ronald Lee, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Mr. Lee is the new assistant provost and director of Equal Opportunity Programs at Michigan State. He is a native of New York, a graduate of West Point, and was selected in the first group of White House fellows in 1965. He then went to the White House staff, then became director of planning and systems analysis for the United States Post Office Department until 1968, at which time he came to Michigan State. Will you please welcome Mr. Lee?
Thank you very much, Marty. It gives me a great deal of pleasure this evening to introduce to you Dr. Selig B. Newbart, Fellow of the American College of Surgeons, and many other things. He's a practicing obstetrician and gynecologist in New Rochelle, New York, which is a small suburb of New York City nestled right among many colleges. He's a clinical instructor in obstetrics and gynecology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx in New York. And he conducts weekly seminars in human sexuality for medical students. He told me just a little while ago that walking across the campus, a Michigan State student ran up to him and he said, "Dr. Newbart, I'm the first baby you ever delivered." And he looked at him and he said, "Oh yes, now I remember. You were the one who cried so much." And the fellow said, "Yes, and every day that I've lived since has indicated why." Dr. Newbart is a graduate of Columbia College and was given an MD degree from Syracuse College of Medicine. He's a founding member of the Association for the Study of Abortion. He's a fellow of the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology and a diplomate of the American College of Surgeons. He's a very popular lecturer. He's recently appeared on national television speaking on the issue of sexuality. He is the author of A Concept of Contraception, published last year. His address is entitled Observations of a Practicing Gynecologist. I present to you Dr. Selig B. Newbart.
I must congratulate you all for coming out tonight. It's a dismal evening to leave, and I hope we make the evening worthwhile for you. Now that I've been introduced, I'd like to introduce you to a gynecologist and give you some idea of what a gynecologist really means. I could tell you something about my training. I graduated from medical school and then spent 1 year as a rotating intern. And then I began my residency program. A residency program is a training program where you live in the hospital and work every day and every other night in whatever field you choose to work in. For my first 2 years, I worked in general surgery. And then for 3 years, I worked in obstetrics and gynecology as a resident. This time was divided half in the delivery suite, delivering babies, and the other half in the operating room, where we operated on the vagina and the female pelvic organs. It's intensive training. And by the time we got done, we were really well trained in gynecological surgery. But the vagina was a very anatomical organ to us. We measured it in terms of its tensile strength and its supports, its distensibility, its anatomical appearance. The thing I want to bring out is that nowhere in gynecological training was any emphasis given to sexuality. When it got above the umbilicus, we weren't interested in it. It was a functional kind of training, and this was my training at good hospitals. And I would say that this is pretty much the training that most surgical specialists get. There was no attempt to discuss sexuality in my training program. And there's very little attempt to discuss sexuality in medical schools. About 4 years ago, we decided that the students at Albert Einstein College of Medicine ought to have some training in sexuality. So we decided to give a short course, probably about 4 hours, discussing sexuality. We thought we would tell the students about the positions of intercourse, perhaps some difficulties that commonly come to a doctor, orgasm problems, some of the work of Masters and Johnson. But my chief did say that we should be sensitive to the students, and whatever they really wanted to know about, we would be prepared to give them. And it turned out that the students wanted much more than positions and intercourse. They were impressed with the fact that ethics and morality is something that's coming into the doctor's office every day now. And a very simple example would be with the birth control pill. When a girl comes and asks the doctor for a prescription for birth control pills, he is in many ways reflecting the morality of the establishment. It can be very easy. A girl 21 years old who's working and out for herself and feels that she is behaving sexually and wants to be secure that she won't get pregnant, we can write her a prescription for the birth control pill. But then you can get progressively more difficult about it. And you can present a case of a 19-year-old girl, and then a 17-year-old girl, and then a 15-year-old girl. And is the doctor going to sit there and continually write out prescriptions for birth control pills, especially if he has the feeling himself that the girl may be using this prescription for destructive purposes? Can he write a prescription for the birth control pill without, in many ways, sanctioning that sort of behavior? And in a busy office, you don't know what a patient is coming in for when she makes an appointment. You have maybe 10 or 15 minutes to spend with her. Can a doctor write a prescription for birth control pills and at the same time get his own philosophy across to her? It's very difficult to do. Then, of course, if you don't write the prescription for the pills, you're up against something else. If you refuse a 15-year-old girl birth control pills because you personally think it's immoral, and she comes back 2 months later with an unwanted pregnancy, the responsibility is very great. And so we had to discuss how the doctor can handle this. How can you get your own personality across and be more than an agent for writing prescriptions for contraceptive pills? We found that our students were interested in the problem of abortion. The only thing a doctor can do now when he meets a patient who needs an abortion is to turn his back on her. We have nothing to offer them. But the students aren't willing to accept that. There is a moral responsibility here. And so we spent time discussing that. They were interested in knowing how to handle their own sexuality in relation to female patients. It's something that had never been discussed at medical school before. Medical students are thrown onto female wards and expected to examine women. And no thought was ever given to the fact that the student himself is a sexual person, and his own feelings had to be taken into account. And these students were anxious to verbalize this. They wanted to know how to handle a seductive patient. It's another thing that we had never been taught. And so right from the beginning, it became apparent that the medical students knew what they wanted, and that a course in sexuality could no longer be a four-hour course talking about positions and intercourse. It's a very encompassing thing. Now our course runs 18 hours. We have consultation from the Department of Urology, Department of Pediatrics, Medicine, Psychiatry, Forensic Medicine, Social Service, Marriage Counselors, each one contributing something to making a well-rounded course concerning sexuality in general. Most abnormal sexuality we leave to the Department of Psychiatry. But I'm talking in terms of the abnormalities that occur within the healthy sexuality of most people. And doctors in practice are now beginning to find that this is a problem. Very few medical schools are teaching this even today. And certainly 10 years ago, no medical school dealt with sexuality. It was not considered part of the doctor's practice. But I'm finding more and more that doctors are disturbed by this, and they feel the lack in this education. Doctors frequently mooch information from each other. You know, some of the stickiest medical problems get solved in the lunchroom over a sandwich. Medical people will come to me and tell me about a girl whose ovary didn't feel just right and get my opinion, or a girl whose menstrual periods are not what they should be, or perhaps someone who hadn't responded to hormone the way she might. And I, in turn, will turn to them when I get into a complicated chemical problem. Or perhaps I'll hear a heart sound in a pregnant girl that bothers me, and I'll discuss it with my medical colleagues. We work these problems out very nicely in the lunchroom. But I found that lately, most of my hallway consultations have been in this field of sexuality, where the practicing doctor is beginning to feel very inadequate. Very typical experience a few months ago, I think, is worth relating. I was having lunch, and in the lunchroom was a very conscientious and capable internist who'd been practicing for many years in New Rochelle and doing a fine job. And all through lunch, he kept giving me signals, high signs, and going like this. I thought he had a tic, but what he was trying to say was outside. And I could tell from the beginning the man was terribly embarrassed. He had something he wanted to talk to me about, and he found it very difficult to approach it. He certainly wasn't going to say anything in the lunchroom. When we finished lunch, we went outside, and he came over to me, and he took me in a corner and looked from side to side. He began speaking out of the side of his mouth, something like Humphrey Bogart and the Maltese Falcon. And his problem was, he said, "Look, Selig, I've got this woman, 33 years old, she's never had an orgasm. And she wants to have an orgasm." He said, "Oh, she keeps coming back to me, I don't know what I'm going to do with her." Now, what he did was, he handled this in perfectly fine medical fashion. He treated it just the way a doctor is supposed to treat it. He examined her completely, and he didn't find anything wrong. And then he turned to the laboratory, and he said, "All her reports have come back normal. Her PBI is normal. Her BMR is normal. I did 17 ketosteroids and 17 hydroxysteroids. They're all normal. What can I do for her?" And I just couldn't resist, and I said to him, "Charlie, is the girl in love?" And he says, "Oh, you don't understand. She's a married woman." And this is medicine as it's practiced. And sexuality is being applied to this standard. And it just doesn't hold up. I know what the average medical doctor in this country wants is a good laboratory test. They would like to draw a little blood and get a serum orgasm level. Really, and if it comes back a little low, give a couple of cc's of orgasmin. And then if her husband complains, give her a little cc of orgasminase and drop her level a little bit until you get the two of them compatible. This is how medicine is practiced. Why not in the field of sexuality? But of course, this field doesn't lend itself to that sort of behavior, and that is the way we are trained in medicine. In the few years that I've made myself available for discussing sexuality, I found a reservoir of disturbance that can't be ventilated under our present system. People who function too well to seek psychoanalysis, but still are troubled enough to need help. They can get help now only when they somatize. We treat vaginal discharge, chronic fatigue, dysmenorrhea, dyspareunia. Instead of trying to prevent these conditions by addressing ourselves to the gnawing sexual problems that underlie them. And as sexuality gets increasingly exposed in the mass media, we find that people become increasingly concerned about their own wasted, misdirected, and often abused sexuality. There is a need for treating these people, and medicine is going to have to face up to it. We may need special medical clinics where sex is dealt with specifically. We may need specially trained social workers who are trained to deal with this. Certainly in 1970, when Masters and Johnson published their second book, which is going to be a book on very practical sex therapy, I hope that a great change will come about our practice. But at the present time, This is a whole area of disturbance that medicine cannot address itself to now. We don't have enough trained people. But the need for better sex education is not limited to physicians. A more honest and rational approach to sexuality is needed for all people at all intellectual levels. Tonight, I would like to detail three areas in which this education is most strikingly needed. Very broadly, these areas will be contraception, marriage, and self-affirmation. When we speak of contraception, we should first look in global terms at population control. It's a dismal thing to look at. You have to appreciate that in the year one, there were 250 million people on the earth. And for the next 1,500 years, the population remained relatively stable. Now, this is all without contraception. There was no contraception. Population was maintained at a steady keel by natural law. Women got pregnant whenever they had intercourse. They would have pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy. But natural law provided, at the other end of the spectrum, three techniques for maintaining a stable population. And they were war, disease, and starvation. It's very easy for us now to think in terms of war, because that specter still hangs over us. It's very real. But I think it's much more difficult for us to appreciate the effect of starvation and disease. When I talk about disease, I don't only mean the fact that we didn't have penicillin and a person who had pneumonia might die, but it was much more than that. There was an enormous fetal wastage. Many of the conceptions that occurred miscarried. Many of the babies that were born dead or died in the first year of life. Women might have to have 5 or 6 children if she expected to have 2 or 3 that would reach adult age. Most important of all, there were epidemics, plagues and epidemics that would sweep across continents and devastate a population. When we speak about starvation, we now are all upset about two small areas of the world that are suffering starvation and people are dying. But in the first 1,500 years, this was common. It was a reality. It was a fact of life. Whole communities would be built around a crop. And if there were a blight, if there were an early frost, if there were a flood, if there were a drought, the crop would die and so would the people. Communities starved out. And population was maintained stable by mass starvation, and this was a reality. It took 1,840 years to get the first 1 billion people on the earth. But the 2 billion people only took 100 years, and the 3 billion people only took 35 years. And now we have 3.5 billion people on the earth, and we can no longer look at how long it takes to make another billion. We have to face the fact that even if every family in the world limited themselves to 3 children, the world population is going to double every 40 years. That's not 1 billion, 2 billion. I'm talking in terms of 7 billion, 14 billion, 28 billion over a 40-year period. Even if we succeed, we have disrupted the natural law. We have turned off death. Every sperm that meets an egg today is going to be a baby. And every baby that's born is going to live, and probably live for 100 or more years. We've never seen an acceleration in population like we can project for the immediate future. World population has taken off at a staggering rate. And most of the demographers who spend all their time in this field are very pessimistic about it. They certainly feel that we are right now too late to avoid mass starvation. And many of them feel that it's actually too late to avoid world catastrophe. So this is a pressing field. And they have big problems. In many areas of the world, there is no motivation. The desire to limit population isn't there. People feel things can't get worse, and they probably aren't going to get better. Most people can't project a better life for themselves no matter what they do. So why should they limit their families? It's probably the only joy they have left to them. And contraception is alien. They have no background for it. They mistrust it. And so controlling world population in spite of the techniques we have is a very complex and difficult job. But what about here in the United States? We have a different situation. We have a tradition of planning. And we can all see the hazards of overpopulation and the terrible tragedy of bearing an unwanted child. We are motivated to limit our pregnancies. Now, why do we so often fail? I can accept a pregnancy in an uneducated woman who is still uninformed about contraception. I hope that the numbers of these women will go down dramatically every year, but they're still present and we have to accept it. I can accept an unplanned pregnancy in a Catholic woman who cannot use a contraceptive. She, after all, is acting out of free choice, and I'm thankful that we still have that available. I can accept a neurotic girl who has a subconscious motivation to conceive for self-destructive purposes. In many instances, the pregnancy is the vehicle that gets this girl to a psychiatrist and the help that she really needs. I can even see the occasional pregnancy that we get from a failed contraceptive, because this is a fact of life. All techniques have a certain percentage of failure, even if used properly. We have to accept this. What I would like to examine is the intelligent girl, knowledgeable in all the techniques of contraception, who presents with an unwanted pregnancy resulting from one exposure with no protection. One exposure. That's the usual story. Women who have active sex lives only rarely have an unplanned pregnancy. It's the girl who risks one exposure, because multiplied by the thousands of such girls is the problem that we see in our office day after day with unplanned pregnancies. Just Monday morning, the day before I left New York, I saw the daughter of a girl who used to work as my office nurse. And she's going away to college, and she came in for some reason, a discharge or irritation or something. But the real thing she was there for was she wanted the birth control pill. And she told me she thought she'd better have them because she was going with someone and was very interested in them and was going to have sex. And I asked her what had she done so far to prevent getting pregnant. And she said to me, well, you know, I haven't been exactly sleeping around. I haven't done anything, but I only had sex once. And she says, you know, it'd be pretty rotten luck to get pregnant the first time you have sex. And I hit her. Now, how do those sperm know that this was the first time she was having sex? One exposure without protection can lead to a pregnancy. And I've seen college girls who've had horrible experiences in the hands of a criminal abortionist. And they come back to my office worried about being pregnant again, and they tell me they had one exposure without protection. Now, why could people who have the facts, who have the motivation, and frequently have the experience, allow themselves at the critical moment to overlook all these things and to disregard a contraceptive? I'm going to put some of the blame on our earliest education in the facts of life. The mysticism that surrounds this thing when we present it to our children, the folklore, the stork psychology. Somewhere there's a bird flying with a bundle in his beak, and he's somehow going to affect what happens in procreation. Somewhere in the dark recesses of our minds, there's this fuzzy notion that there's magic involved, there's mysticism involved, there's even a bird involved. At the basis of this psychology is the assumption that the procreative act is evil, and children should be spared the lurid details. In its place is put a garbled myth that beclouds the issue and returns at a critical moment to rob us of our personal responsibility to preclude pregnancy. Now, I don't think procreation is dirty. I find it beautiful. And the truth is much easier for young minds to comprehend than that bird thing. The facts of life, taught honestly from the time a child begins to ask about it, will lay a foundation for sex education that is free of shame or guilt, and that will be appreciated at every level of the mind as practical and reliable. Early sex education, given by people who are comfortable with it and sexually healthy themselves, is an absolute requirement for the consistent use of contraception. We've come a long way in this field, but there's an awfully long road ahead. The Sex Information and Education Council of the United States, the CECUS, you must have heard of it, and especially its field director, Mary Calderon, have gone around the country awakening people to the need for sex education, and they've done a great job. If only we didn't have to deal with the parents. I was recently asked by a private movie company that is engaged in making sex education films for sale to schools if I would write a film on contraception for them, and they told me we want it straight from the shoulder. Well, I handed them an outline, and we soon discovered that our shoulders were at different levels. Almost everything I wanted to say, I couldn't say, and everything I wanted them to show, they wouldn't show. And over again, they reminded me that in order to sell these films to a school, it would have to be bought by the school board. And it seemed that the members of the school board that I hadn't offended in my first paragraph, I got in my second paragraph. And in order not to offend any of the school board members, I would have had to write a movie which would be pretty much a rehash of what I had in elementary school, in physical hygiene. And I learned sex from my friends on the street. And I learned it poorly. And I learned it so thoroughly that it took me years to relearn it. We know where babies come from, and we know it very precisely. And this is just how we should tell it to our children, very precisely, without the shadow of a doubt. Because I believe that it's these very shadows and doubts that we plant in young minds that come back to haunt us in later years as pregnancies from that one exposure to unprotected sex. And I feel equally unhappy about God's role in procreation. Whoever is responsible for the distribution of babies in this world has done absolutely the most blunderous job imaginable. Now, why should God take the rap? A good defense lawyer could spring him in a minute. Let's take as Exhibit A the town whore. An evil wench. If she doesn't use contraceptives, she'll be blessed with pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy. And for Exhibit B, you can take the Sunday school teacher, a lovely woman who has never entertained an evil thought. But if you put an intrauterine contraceptive device in her, she could divide her time equally between going to church and her bedroom, and she will never be blessed until she removes the contraceptive, and then she'll be able to get pregnant. God may have a strong influence in our marriage, in our ability to love, in our decision to have a family or to postpone it. But the actual process of fertilization is a purely human responsibility. We must teach this in the most straightforward way. Intercourse results in pregnancy unless appropriate contraceptive measures are taken. Now, this is a fact. Everything else that I'm going to say is just an elaboration of this fact. Responsibility for pregnancy cannot be ignored, and it cannot be shared. An unwanted conception is always the result of a human irresponsibility. There is no cop-out. Proper sex education should also deal with techniques of contraception. Too many women have told me that they were taking the pill, but they had to stop because of undesirable side effects. And then, as though they were at the mercy of their fate, they became pregnant. Now, these women have been entertaining the choice of taking the pill or not taking the pill. They were not entertaining the choice of taking the pill or using the diaphragm or using a condom or withdrawing or using MCO foam. This is a very superficial knowledge of contraception. Much of this confusion is the fault of the medical profession. I believe that we've given too much emphasis to contraceptive effectiveness and have thereby depreciated some fine techniques in the eyes of the layman. Women who are using no contraceptive at all have told me that they know about EMCO foam and it's very easy to use, but their doctors told them that it wasn't very effective. Wasn't very effective compared to no contraceptive at all. It's magnificently effective. The key to success in any technique is consistent use. The adage in contraception is that the least effective contraceptive, if it's used every single time, will be more effective than the most effective technique if you use it every once in a while. We have 8 contraceptive techniques available to us. Now, any doctor will tell you when you have 8 medicines to cure one illness, it means that we haven't found the right medicine. And so it is with family planning. The perfect contraceptive is not even on the drawing board yet. But any of the techniques that are available will be satisfactory if they're properly used, and we're each free to choose the technique that's best suited to our purpose. But being free to choose is only a reality when one is familiar with all the choices. Knowing where to buy a condom is not understanding contraception. Being able to get your hands on a pack of pills isn't solving the problem. Sex education should include the whole concept of contraception. Full understanding of each technique, how it works, why it works, its good points, its bad points, and only then can you be interested in its percentage of failure if properly used. Because all of these techniques, if properly used, have a very low percentage of failure. Now, in order to affect a pregnancy, a sperm has to meet an egg in the woman's fallopian tube. To prevent a pregnancy, we can prevent it at several levels. We can eliminate the sperm with a condom or withdrawal. We can block the sperm with a diaphragm or EMCO foam or a surgical operation. We can eliminate the egg by taking oral contraceptives. In each case, we are preventing fertilization with a specific contraceptive technique. Now, I go through this very basic review because I still see many frantic young women who needlessly aggravate themselves into a missed menstrual period. There's no magic in contraception. The sperm absolutely must meet an egg in order to affect a pregnancy. Patients come to my office and they nervously confess to me that they're late with the period and they had intercourse. But on further questioning, I learned that their lover had used a condom and he had put it on prior to insertion and that at the end of the coitus, the condom remained on his penis and it was intact. Now, I don't have to kill a rabbit to tell that girl she's not pregnant. She has absolutely nothing to fear. She couldn't be pregnant. And usually, just this reassurance will bring down a menstrual period for confirmation. But on the other hand, I see a lot of young women who are confident that they're not pregnant because their only exposure was during a safe period. And I don't approach this patient with quite the same aplomb. Masters and Johnsons have demonstrated that many women are stimulated to ovulation by sexual intercourse. These women have perfectly normal cycles, but in addition to the mid-cycle ovum extruded every month, they extrude additional eggs whenever they reach a peak of sexual excitement. And other women are just habitually irregular in their ovulation. The result is that they never have a safe period. There are, at best, only times of less fertility and times of more fertility in each cycle. Women who use the rhythm system for contraception can never be confident that they're not pregnant. And the only acceptable reason for using this technique at all is religious. Most of the unplanned pregnancies that I see come from one exposure to intercourse, and it's usually at a safe time. An unmarried woman who relies on the rhythm system even once is not only tempting fate, she is begging it. If her religion prohibits a contraceptive, she must be made aware that it more vigorously prohibits extramarital intercourse. And if there are no religious implications, and she's simply chosen to have sex without protection because she believes it to be a safe time, I would urge her to choose again. There's no excuse for the rhythm system outside of marriage. So again, education. When children are taught how babies are conceived, they should be taught how babies are not conceived. A realistic concept of contraception should be part of our early education. Now, I mentioned earlier that with every technique, there is a small but definite failure rate. And even with the best techniques, there are a certain percentage of failure, even though they're small. Now, we have some commitment to these women as well. When I say we, I mean specifically the medical profession, but basically everyone, society in general, has a commitment. And here, of course, we're talking about abortion. The question is not, shall we permit abortion, but rather, shall we permit women to bear children that they don't want? Shall we force women to bear children conceived by mistake or by failure? By abortion, I mean the surgical termination of a pregnancy during the first 3 months of gestation. And I would first point out that this operation, done by a qualified person in a hospital operating room, is extremely safe. It's safer than a tonsillectomy. It's safer than delivery of a baby. There are no medical complications. The patient's ability for future childbearing does not suffer. And I also want to emphasize that no proposal has ever been made that would coerce a woman into terminating a pregnancy that she would be anxious to carry. I'm talking about abortion on a voluntary basis. In an attempt to get repeal of the current abortion laws, we've done extensive polling, and we have a very good idea of the position that most people take around the country. It's very interesting. When presented with a particular case, a married woman with, say, financial hardship, a possible congenital defect, a physical or mental illness, and especially assuming that the woman requests an abortion, the majority of people polled would always agree that abortion should be granted. But when asked about repeal of the abortion laws or granting abortion on demand, the response is usually negative. Now, polls of professional people, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, gynecologists, give a much higher approval of abortion on demand. But in polling lay people in almost all areas of the country, the response indicates a broad approval for abortion reform, but almost never approval for abortion on demand. And this, I think, reflects poorly on our ability to think logically in sexual matters. If one is free to think about abortion and gives it any amount of consideration, abortion on demand is the only sensible moral conclusion. Who but the pregnant woman should decide the fate of the pregnancy? Who but the pregnant woman will be left to deal with the products of the pregnancy? She alone will bear the child, and she alone will provide the love and attention that the child has a right to expect. Now, who in the world better than she can decide on her ability to handle it? No matter how skillful the surgeon, or how righteous the clergyman, how wise the judge, or how learned the men who sit on a hospital abortion committee, the ultimate decision to bear a child or to jettison the pregnancy can only be made by the woman concerned. Society, of course, should offer the patient the counsel and the service of all of these learned men, but the ultimate decision is hers alone. And behind the reluctance to give women the freedom of not bearing unwanted children is the need to use pregnancy as a punishment. What we are saying is conception results from sin, and punishment is the reward of the sinner. Repeal of abortion laws will confirm our belief that pregnancy results from intercourse, not sin. That pregnancy is a privilege, never an obligation. And one does not punish with a privilege. The whole concept of pregnancy as a punishment is evil. In the first place, the woman is deemed guilty without ever getting a trial. In the second place, the punishment is usually far greater than her degree of malfeasance. And most important of all, the severest punishment is given to the most innocent party of all, and that is the child. I've spent a great many hours in public debate on the issue of abortion law repeal, and I invariably go home with the feeling that once again we missed the whole point. We discuss whether the pregnancy is life, and when does life begin, and what are the rights of the unborn child, and are we ever justified in taking innocent life, and so on and so on. And I believe that the real issues in our abortion dilemma are never clearly stated. The most important is that the issue is one of religion. Most people favor substantial abortion reform. No more proof of this is needed than the fact that so many people seek abortion as a personal solution to an unplanned pregnancy. Opposition to reform is the province of the Catholic clergy. Now, the Church clearly teaches that life begins at the moment of conception. Abortion is therefore murder. And so the Catholic clergy will defend our abortion laws with the same zeal that I would defend our manslaughter laws. Now, I'm just as convinced that life does not begin at conception. The conceptus has a potential for life, I grant that. But to consider the mass of cells in a 6-week gestation as a human being is to distort this potential beyond my limits. Life to me does not begin at conception, and therefore abortion to me is not evil. Now, how in the world can these two points of views ever stand up to debate? When we speak of abortion, we're not even speaking about the same thing. It would be evil for these divergent points of view to ever compromise. If a priest advocates abortion for any indication, he is recommending murder, and he's grievously compromising his morality. If I am forced to deny abortion to a woman that I honestly feel should not bear a child, I'm demeaning the dignity of a human being, and to me, this is the height of immorality. Our ethics demand that each of us hold fast to our beliefs and not compromise. So why the debates? We're a pluralistic society. We're each free to reject an alien belief and follow our own moral dictates. I think it's the duty of all concerned citizens to make the Church aware of how strongly we hunger to follow our own morality. And it is the particular duty of the Catholic citizen, because he has a much more influential voice. Experience tells us that Catholics seek illegal abortions in the same proportions as Protestants and Jews. The fight to repeal the abortion laws is the fight of the moral Catholic as well. An abortion practice is not affected by our current law. Any woman who wants to get unpregnant and has $500 in cash will get an abortion. It's common knowledge, and it's all too common in experience. The present law only serves two purposes. It excludes all our indigent population from selecting an abortion as an out. And I think that that's terribly discriminating. And the second thing is, it guarantees that the operation be done by quacks and charlatans, and that it be done in disreputable places and under hazardous conditions. I don't think any woman ever gets pregnant so that she can have an abortion. The decision to have an abortion is always sad. It's a defeat. It's a difficult decision for any woman to make. But once a woman makes that decision based on her own value judgment, society doesn't have to punish her anymore. Once that decision is made, we should be able to offer that woman an abortion with dignity and by the doctor of her choice and at a price that's comparable to all the other medical care that she gets. I believe this is our obligation. The next area I'm going to talk about is the area of marriage. And again, I believe that our early education in marriage is unrealistic, and the fruits of this deception return to haunt us. When you look at the divorce statistics, it's a little disconcerting. But I think you also have to bear in mind that we're dealing with a new kind of marriage now that society has had very little experience with. Marriage used to be a social goal. People would marry to preserve the family line, to hold property, to pass on title. It's only in the last 20, 30 years that our goals have really involved personal happiness for the couple and a love affair, where the wife is also the mistress and the companion and the sharer of everything. This is a difficult goal to achieve. I think it's admirable that we're trying to do it, but I don't think we can expect crackerjack divorce statistics. I think our current statistics are sadder than they have to be. Most polls indicate that one half of all married couples are sorry that they got involved in the marriage. That's a little depressing. And I think to a large extent, it reflects our preparation for marriage. It's this fairy tale philosophy again. A few years ago, the president of the Association of Marriage Counselors addressed the medical group, and she told a wonderful story that I think is very relevant. She was bemoaning the fact that children are raised on fairy tales, and they always end with they were married and live happily ever after. And she went into the story about the poor young girl who was put a spell by a wicked witch, and she went to sleep, and 5 years later a charming prince passed, and he kissed her, and she woke up, and they got married, and they lived happily ever after. Now, this assumes that he's going to take her back to the palace. Will she know how to dress? Won't she flounder in the etiquette and protocol of the palace? Will he be ashamed of her manners? Or even worse, will she think that he's ashamed of her manners? Won't she ever want to invite her family to the palace? And won't they embarrass the prince? But most important of all, who do you think is living in the palace? Her mother-in-law, the queen. And how can they possibly get along? And won't sooner or later she throw the whole thing up to him and say, the king is going to review the troops. You've been out there being a prince all week, and on Sunday when the troops are going to be reviewed, the king is going to review the troops. Why doesn't the prince ever review the troops? When are you going to grow up and go out and get a country of your own? Now this is reality. Happy ever after does not follow a kiss on the cheek. Happy ever after follows making a wise choice and giving it plenty of time to prove itself, and then giving it a real tryout before the addition of children. I think another problem in our marriage preparation is this overemphasis on marriage and sex. You look at any marriage manual and you're going to find a sex book. I did a television show a few months ago in which I spoke about sexuality, and I was inundated with mail. It was lynch mail. And the thing that upset people the most was that I spoke about sex and I didn't speak about marriage. How can you speak about sex without speaking about marriage? And several people told me, actually, didn't I know that marriage was an institution in which you have sex? Now that's my definition of a whorehouse. I don't know. The notion of marriage as an institution for sex depreciates both marriage and intercourse. And I think we'll be able to improve both sexuality and the institution of marriage by making more of the word love. Love can be expressed by holding hands, and more love can be expressed by kissing. A great love may be expressed by petting or necking. The ultimate expression of love is sexual intercourse. When a couple is in love is convinced that their relationship will stand the test of time, they can formalize it in marriage and enjoy the complete sharing of experience that only marriage allows. Of course, there will be sex, but not as a result of marriage, but rather as a result of love. When a marriage goes on the rocks, there is usually sexual incompatibility. But I think it's destructive simplification to look directly into the bedroom to find the culprit. When a couple falls badly out of love, they should not enjoy themselves sexually. It would be immoral. Only a whore will copulate without affection. Only a stud will get an erection for a purely mechanical act. I've discussed marriage breakdowns with a great many patients, usually because they would like to cure their problems by improving the sexual aspects. I usually find that sex is a barometer of the relationship rather than a guiding factor. In-law problems, money problems, divergence of interest, a dissimilarity of taste, all of these things are far more common than sexual incompatibility in the patients that I treat. Of course, as the marriage deteriorates, so will the sex. But if I were able to treat just the sexual aspect, I could make a multi-orgasmic monster out of this woman, but if her mother-in-law is still a bitch, the marriage will still go on the rocks. So I think purely looking at it sexually is a defeating sort of thing. And then the notion that sex and marriage are one and the same thing leads to a temptation to test a marriage sexually. If sex is the most important part of marriage, we can try sex. And if we can make it in bed, we can get married and we have nothing to worry about. But sex isn't that simple. If you open 10 cans of Campbell's soup, you will always get 10 cans of Campbell's soup. You'll get the same amount of vegetables and the same amount of bologna. But if you put 10 men into a bed with 10 women, you're going to get 10 different experiences, and some of them won't even be sexual. Intercourse that a couple has during courtship is a singular experience. It's a barometer of nothing. Their sex lives before children will be different than their sex lives after children. Their sex life in a one-room apartment will be different than their sex life in a suburban home. Sex life before menopause will be different from sex after menopause. As a matter of fact, Monday night sex will be different than Tuesday night sex. That's the beautiful thing about it. It doesn't get boring and it's never predictable. And the most we can say is that sex will always be best when the feeling of love is the strongest. And a marriage will be good as long as love lasts. So separating our preoccupation with sex in marriage from reality, I think that we can look at our courtship practices and make some drastic improvements. First of all, I would recommend a long engagement. It should be obvious that it's easier to get disengaged than it is to get dismarried. And the longer you have an engagement, the more likely you are to be sure that the person you're marrying is the right person. And if it's not the right person, the engagement period is the time to take it off. Now, I think a couple who's engaged should enjoy sex together, not as a barometer of what their marriage is going to be, not to enable them to predict anything, but to enjoy it as a healthy, enjoyable thing. And also, I think that a long engagement is only possible when the couple is enjoying sexuality together. It's a good way to get to know one another well. And most important of all, it's your only opportunity to have premarital sex. Because once you get married, you just can't do that. I think that people ought to be taught to enjoy a person for what he is, not for what you hope he will be. So many couples, when they're discussing why their marriage broke down, come out with the fact that they never really liked each other in the first place. He wasn't really crazy about her, but he thought that she would be something. The marriage would somehow change her. Marriage changes nobody. I think it's important to be comfortable with the other person's taste. Taste is an extremely important thing in marriage. You're going to spend so much time in your home environment, and the way that home is decorated is going to reflect your spouse's taste, and the way your children are dressed, and the way they behave, and the way your company is served, and the way you're entertained. The spouse's taste is extremely important, and divergent taste can be very irritating over a period of time. If taste is incompatible, I think it can be a problem. And then family can't be ignored. Many people have tried, but you just can't ignore family. In-laws do not go away, they visit. And along with family, I think that color and religion are also factors that have to be seriously considered. Statistics show us pretty definitely that the further away you go from your own social milieu, the less statistical chance your marriage has of succeeding. Now, of course, there can be exceptions. And couples who are well-meaning can overcome all obstacles. But I think to go into a relationship without really examining these obstacles is foolhardy. Most important of all, I think that after marriage, a couple should postpone childbearing for several years. Because no matter what you do before you marry, you always marry a stranger. You never really know someone until you enter into this total sharing relationship of a marriage. And if you give yourself 1 or 2 years of marriage before you have children, you'll first of all enjoy the years. I think that it's a great deal of fun. And second of all, you will know that the relationship has stood the test of time before it's cemented with children. Because even marriage is reversible, but children are irreversible. And once you've elected to bring a child into the world, you have a great obligation to keep that thing going. Dr. Margaret Mead suggested some steps for a double marriage. And I think that those things are worth re-examining, and I think we may come to that. And that may be our way out of these awful statistics that I quoted you about divorce and happiness in marriage. And the final area for my discussion tonight concerns self-affirmation. And self-affirmation is essentially ego strength. And that has always been a very important factor in achieving happiness. But I don't think there was ever a time when young egos were as severely tested as they are today. The mass media are being encouraged by an establishment that is eager to read lurid stories that will confirm their opinion about the younger generation. They're convinced that young people are breaking all the rules and have abandoned our sexual mores. Now, this fact alone is so unimportant that I probably wouldn't even mention it. In fact, I will probably just sit back and enjoy it, except for one sad aspect. It seems to me that a growing number of college students are beginning to believe this also, and this is damaging. If there ever were rules in sexuality, I don't remember them. How could one ever define propriety in a sexual encounter? We would have to have a long and complicated list of rules. At age 13, you can kiss on the cheek, and at age 15, you can kiss on the lips, and at age 17, you can soul kiss, and perhaps light petting under column A, and column A would be light petting above the clothes, above the waist, or light petting, and that sort of thing. You could never define rules in a sexual encounter. It's impossible. And our sexual morality was equally nebulous. Think about it for a moment. Society would insist that all women marry as virgins and all men be sexually experienced when they get married. Now, this could be a plea for homosexuality. But you know it isn't. And the morality had the feeling that sex could be turned on and off with a flick of the switch. Before marriage, a girl couldn't have sex no matter how badly she wanted it. And after marriage, she had to have sex no matter how much she didn't want it. And not only would she have sex, but on her wedding day, she would be a virgin. And on her wedding night, she would have sex and she should be good at it. It's impossible. The true meaning of all of this morality, the true basis for this hypocrisy, is that sex is evil and we should all be ashamed. The old morality was designed to guarantee feelings of guilt. It began as soon as a person was old enough to masturbate. I think that young people now reject this notion of sin. We know that sex can be healthy and beautiful. We are not ashamed of our sexuality and therefore refuse to hide it or indulge ourselves in pretended shame. This, to me, is the real meaning of the sexual revolution. And this is the thinking that enables us to take 2 weeks in open and constructive discussion of a subject that just a few years ago was absolutely taboo. But along with being proud of what you do, you must also be proud of what you don't do. You must make a stand at what you, as an individual, think is right. A stand based on your values, not your roommates. On your emotions, not your classmates. Based on your own private, unique, and infinitely precious personality. Being a cog in a new machine is just as depressing as being a cog in an old machine. And I am frankly disturbed at the pressure being exerted on young people to become a cog in this new machine. Too many college girls have told me that they were pressured into sexual adventures that they didn't feel ready for, that they weren't anxious for, and that ultimately proved to be destructive rather than healthy experiences. I would implore each of you as individuals to strive for self-affirmation in your own sex life. And to all of you collectively, to keep your society free of the pressures that tend to make people a herd. And I'm not just talking to the women now. The last few years has seen a leveling of the double standard in sexuality. At the present time, men are being hurt just as often as women. I think the sexual behavior of the current college student has been dreadfully misinterpreted in the press, but I really don't think it matters. If one is to be swayed to do anything by the argument that everyone is doing it, then there really is no freedom and no honesty. Self-affirmation is a very positive goal in a sexually enlightened environment. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Michigan State University, I would like to thank you, Dr. Neubart, for participating this evening and contributing so much to our experimental colloquy. Because Dr. Neubart will now be attending living unit discussions, there will be no question and answer period at this time. Thank you very much for attending.
I had gin before I came.
I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Where is it, Marty?